From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We're coming to you today from the Wisconsin State Fair. And on the program, Wisconsin foodie Kyle Cherik explains the appeal of State Fair cuisine.
I look at this like one of the great bazaars, right? You go to Morocco, you might sample a whole bunch of things if you're never going to go back. You can't eat everything because you'd be stuffed by the third stall, but that's how I enjoy the State Fair when I come for the food.
Then the head of Wisconsin's 4-H program explains how pop culture informs their programming.
Archery is one of the top newer programs that is really drawing great membership, and it's because of the Hunger Games.
And garden expert Melinda Myers explains why she feels so connected to the State Fair.
Gardening helps us appreciate what the farmers do. It gets us in tune with nature.
Lake Effect from the State Fair is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We are at the Wisconsin State Fair in West Allis this morning, recording our show on the We Energies Energy Park stage. As delicious as they are, we are not actually here for the cream puffs. Not at this early point in the show, anyway. We'll hear a bit about them later.
We're actually here because all summer Lake Effect has been showcasing agriculture in Wisconsin in our series called Full Plate. We have talked about bees. We've heard about efforts to grow rice here in Wisconsin. We've learned about the dairy industry, farmers markets, and grocery store trends. And we'll have many more stories to come as the harvest approaches.
The Wisconsin State Fair celebrates Wisconsin's agricultural heritage, past, present, and future, and the fair itself is where we will start this morning.
Our guest, Kyle Cherik, is a regular commentator and contributor to Lake Effect about all things food-related. You'll also know him as the host of the award-winning show on PBS, Wisconsin Foodie. Kyle, thank you so much for getting us started this morning.
Good morning, and happy State Fair. I don't know what the salutation is, but...
welcome to the State Fair,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, welcome to the State, the Wisconsin State Fair, the greatest State Fair.
Our State Fair is a great State Fair.
I think it's the greatest.
It's the best.
Yeah.
The best State Fair, and that's where we're going to start with a little history of the State Fair. When did it start and why?
Right, so 1851, not in Milwaukee or West Allis as we know it now, where it's headquartered. It started in Janesville, Wisconsin, and we think of the State Fair of being 11 days in August, and that's the tradition, lay out your clothes, make your summer plans. The original State Fair was in October, and it was only 2 days. Took up a whole bunch of acres, just a vast 6 acres.
In October, this was harvest time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they couldn't do it in August because the farmers needed to be in the field. So just after harvest time or at the very cusp so that folks could come. And it was really a membership drive by the Wisconsin Agricultural Society to get more members.
So they just wanted farmers to join the
Correct.
Association.
Okay. Correct, yeah. Bring that institutional knowledge together and then show off a little bit the longest row you could plow, literally, and, you know, poles and so on and so forth.
The tilt-a-whirl had not yet been invented.
Well, if it had, I mean, maybe they were rocking it at Coney Island, but in Janesville they were taking a pass on that. Yeah, no question. And from there, the fair traveled around the state for 41 years. Locations like Fond du Lac and Madison and Milwaukee and so on and so forth. Madison actually had it the most in those 41 years. But get this, that first year, historians put the number of folks that showed up from 13,000 to 18,000 in 1851 for the Wisconsin State Fair. In 1858, when Lincoln was debating Douglas for the senatorial seat for Illinois, and he would lose but then go on to win the presidency, so not too bad. Anyway, his first debate in Ottawa, Illinois, another small town, on a river, only about 12,000 people show up.
So more to the fair.
Yeah, so that tells you the power of, well, not cream puffs yet, but I mean of a state fair.
Okay, so you mentioned Lincoln, and I gather there is a Lincoln connection to the Wisconsin State Fair.
There's a really great Lincoln connection. So in 1859, when he was on the stump, he came to the Wisconsin State Fair, and he gave the opening address. And he was so prescient in his comments. He basically mapped out what the Wisconsin idea would become. He extolled the virtues of what a state fair does, called us a soon-to-be great state, because, of course, we had only become one in 1848. So he's speaking, you know, just a decade later. But he talked about how this is the place to meet people, this is the place to know your neighbor, and there's no better endeavor than the labor of the land mixed with intellectual thought. So he was saying, basically, this is where the erudition of the mind comes together with things that you grow to help people. It's a really elegant speech, and reading it, I mean, he was a great orator, but I get, as a guy who's into ag and food and things like that, I get goosebumps reading it, because he so treasured what this state and what agriculture was about. But no surprise, he came from Illinois.
Well, and so he made that speech at the Wisconsin State Fair.
At the Wisconsin State Fair, and he starts out saying, I'm not going to tell you about farming because I'm not a farmer. And then the next two paragraphs, his stats on a bushel of wheat and a bushel of corn and how much you can grow are so spot on, you would think that he had 25 acres he was taking care of on his off time. I mean, the man was a master.
And I hear he was a huge cream puff fan.
Well, the cream puffs didn't come along until 1924.
All right.
So, yeah, we have to wait a little bit for the cream puffs. There's, but it's worth the wait.
Well, so let's jump around a little bit here and think about the fair today. And we're recording it fairly early, so the number of people walking by is, this is actually a very quiet time for the fair. But in general, how does the fair impact our view of agriculture? The people that come to this fair, how do they connect the stuff that the fair celebrates with the stuff that goes on outside the fairgrounds?
Right. So I'm of the impression that there's really two fairs that go on. There are farmers and their families that raise these incredible animals and bring them here on display in competition. And if you spend any time with them, they're not in the Midway. They're not out eating cream puffs. They're really managing their animals, tending to their livestock, and then getting them ready for competition. But they will spend all year or years preparing for this. So this is a really big deal for them, and this is a point of pride. To win that accommodation is something no one can ever take away from you, and it's a mixture of art and science and love of the animal.
And so who are they? Are they competing with each other? Are they hoping to impress each other, or are they actually looking for markets?
They're looking for markets, but they're competing against each other for the prize-winning animal. Yeah. I know you're going to have another guest that talked about the governor's beef auction that happened last night, and that is a seminal event that, if you haven't gone to, just make a point next year, because it's terrific. But these, I mean, I go to two fairs and I experience it two ways. One day I go just for the animals and the majesty of what they are and the pride of the people that are raising them, which goes all the way back to the earliest days of humankind, right? And then I come another day and I just eat a lot of crazy food and go on the big slide and do the sky glider. And that's a true fair experience too.
Wisconsin foodie, you come for the crazy food. This seems counter to the foods that you celebrate on your show.
Yeah, no question. And I eat a lot of different things, and I don't finish everything, and it seems a little bit wasteful, but I look at this like one of the great bazaars, right? So you go to Morocco, you might sample a whole bunch of things if you're never going to go back. And you can't eat everything because you'd be stuffed by the third stall, but that's how I enjoy the state fair when I come for the food.
So for the people who are not living in the country, people who don't haven't mm-hmm. grown up on farms, there are a lot of city folks and suburban folks who come to the fair. What do they get by seeing the majesty of the animals, by seeing the pride that farmers and animal husbandry folks have in the animals that they raise?
Well, I think it brings us back to who we really are as a state. We've always been an agricultural state. We were a state almost entirely of wheat. Pre-Civil War, through the Civil War, we essentially saved the North with the wheat production that came out of Wisconsin and was shipped out through the Great Lakes and the rivers that were not blockaded and so forth. And because wheat is so depletive, really by the 1860s and 70s, in came the pigs and the cows. And when you think of the large animals of the globe, so you've got horses, you've got pigs, you've got cows, you've got lamb, and you've got sheep. We're pretty big in two, you could even argue three of those. And by 1899, 90% of the farms in the state were dairy. So it was this incredible switch over. And if you're not in touch with that in your day-to-day life, maybe you're living in a suburb, what have you, and you don't exactly know where your food comes from, you come to the state fair and you're intimately acquainted with that, and you can talk to the people that raise the animals that feed your family.
And the state fair also had a role in helping pave roads, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's always been this great blend of sort of political subterfuge. I mean, Taft came here with Doug LaFollette and things like that. There was a adjunct professor, associate professor, University of Wisconsin in the early days of their agriculture department in the early 20th century, who used his good roads bill, or really introduced it to people in the state fair, to try and change the legislature, convince them, because farmers had to keep up their own roads. And he said, whoa, we're the major industry in the state. I think the state could probably help with this. He ended up getting it passed in 1912, but that 1911 fair was, hello, everybody. Let's think about the farmers. They're fixing their own roads and then feeding you along the way.
You said something interesting earlier. Actually, you said a lot of interesting things earlier, but cream puffs actually have been a part of the equation here for almost 100 years?
Almost 100 years, yeah. The Wisconsin Bakers Association, who have been making them. The building that you walk up to and into now to get your cream puff, if you don't go to one of the ancillary stands or, you know, now you can just call
the drive-through.
The drive-through cream puff, yeah, exactly. A later innovation. But the building that you walk into where you can watch the cream puff production dates back to 1924, built by the Wisconsin Bakers Association, and incredible just from a culinary standpoint compared to others of its ilk in the country, an incredible institution. And the numbers of the cream puffs, I don't have, they're just boggling. But yeah, they've been making them since 1924.
It's interesting because it kind of blows me away. In 1924, there may well have been hitching posts outside the cream puff pavilion.
The State Historical Society has got some incredible pictures on their website of the state fair through the years. And you see things like the American Telephone and Telegraph Company with a big banner that's kind of drooping because it was a windy day, describing how you can talk to friends and relatives in the next state.
Whoa!
Right? You know,
have your cream puff.
Yeah, and have your cream puff. This is new technology. And the way that people, I mean, now we come comfortably in shorts and t-shirts and so on and so forth. Everybody dressed up. You wore a full suit. You wore a full dress.
And you can't see this on the radio, but we are all in full suits.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right, yeah.
Bonnie is in an evening gown, but
my point being that coming to the state fair was much more of a, it wasn't a fine event, but it was much more of an occasion. And it was a celebration of the state's agriculture, and where you would see some acts and some other things that you wouldn't see anywhere else. It wasn't quite carnival, but it was something that you stepped up your game and you made a point to come to. That first one in 1851, I mean, now in Milwaukee, people know that when Harley-Davidson comes in with their anniversary, people rent out their homes and hotels. It was the same thing in Janesville. People were renting out their barn lofts so that guests could come to the original Wisconsin State Fair.
We only have a few seconds left, Kyle, but what's your favorite thing to do when you come to the fair?
Eat a cream puff, go on the big slide, visit the gorgeous animals.
Do you have particular fair memories that when you think of all the times you've been to the fair, like this was the time that it really was the fair?
No, I mean, I have the time that a goat ate like a corner of my t-shirt without me knowing.
Well, that's all right.
Yeah, that's something, you know. But no, beyond that, I've got... And then once when we were filming Wisconsin Foodie, I had a cow back up on me as I was doing an intro, and that was neat, too.
Well, Kyle Cherik, thank you so much.
Happily, thank you.
And stick around. We're going to have you back in a few minutes.
I'm here.
Kyle Cherik is the host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS and a regular Lake Effect contributor. Thanks for being here, Kyle. We will take a short break and then
we'll return by Dale Lighthizer, the state program director of 4-H. You are listening to Lake Effect at the State Fair on 89.7 WUWM.
For from We Energy's Energy Park at the Wisconsin State Fair, Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin's 4-H program has been working with kids for more than a century. The organization's name is a reference to its original motto, Head, Hearts, Hands, and Health. And full disclosure, I was a 4-H kid.
Although the program has changed over the years, I think Bonnie is no longer in 4-H, but no. It still maintains some roots in the celebration of rural and agricultural work, offering hands-on learning experiences in horticulture, animal sciences, and more.
Joining us now is Dale Lighthizer, the State Program Director of the 4-H Youth Development Program. Dale, thanks so much for driving over here and spending some time with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So give us some history of the 4-H program here in Wisconsin. When did it first start?
Well, you know, I'd like to reflect back on Abraham Lincoln as well.
Okay.
In 1862, there was a legislator from Vermont, Justin Merrill, who proposed a bill that was signed by President Lincoln that formed the land-grant university system. And we all know that the University of Wisconsin-Madison is our land-grant university. What that legislation did is it granted land to all of the states to do three different things. One was to do education, which all universities do. The second thing was to do research that related to the people of the state. And the third thing was to take that education and that knowledge that was developed and give it back to the people of the state. And that's what University of Wisconsin Extension is about. That's what 4-H Youth Development is about. So in 1902, there were innovations that came about in agriculture in particular because 80 or 90% of our state population was engaged in production agriculture. And there were hybrid corns, corn seeds that were developed that far outproduced the fertile corn that farmers were used to planting. And farmers were not adopting this new innovation. And so there was an educator in Ohio who decided, let me get together a group of boys and we'll have these boys plant a demonstration plot of corn and demonstrate to their fathers the value of this new innovation. So at the end of the year, boys would measure their yield, and they would say, Dad, what's your yield? And Dad would say, my yield of corn was 35 bushels an acre, or whatever it happened to be. And dads would say, what was your yield? And boys would puff up their chest, and they would say, 120 bushels, 200 bushels, 235 bushels. There was a young boy in North Carolina that I think set the record of 235 bushels an acre. What do you think those parents did? They saw the value in buying fertile seed or the hybrid seed as opposed to just retaining that fertile seed that they'd been used to.
So in a strange way, 4-H traces its roots to kids showing up their parents.
Absolutely. And changing the behavior of their parents. Yeah, yeah.
The idea that kids can change the world here in some way.
Yeah, one parent at a time.
So when did 4-H become more like training students and training young people to know how to do farming or to do other things? When did that happen?
Well, you know, there was an evolution of things. You know, the corn clubs really came first. And the second thing that happened, there were more innovations, more technology, more research done. And our University of Wisconsin did the primary research on vitamins, really discovering what vitamins were all about. And in the 1930s, we discovered that a lack of vitamin C caused scurvy in people. And scurvy was a real problem in the winter for people in our state and around the country because fresh fruits were not available at that time. Well, they found that tomatoes were high in vitamin C. And they started to have girls canning clubs, just as we'd had boys corn clubs. And so people really started canning a lot of tomatoes, and it became a status symbol. People would line their shelves and their mantles and their windows to have all these canned tomatoes on display. And there was no decrease in scurvy.
Well, so how?
So you know what happened? I got to finish the story here.
I'm waiting here. Yes.
Okay. Well, people were. It was such a status symbol. People weren't eating the tomatoes, So they had to go back in and do recipes and you know fundamental ways to use those tomatoes.
So you'd get the vitamin C.
So you would get right. The vitamin C. Yeah. Yeah.
This was like the old days when people, you know, the colonial landowners would have a pineapple to display their wealth, but they would never eat that pineapple because they thought it was, you know, they were consuming their wealth.
Sure, right. Sure. So over time, we've really evolved into a program where the research has been about the projects that we offer. And in the last 20 years, it's been a lot more about what are the results that we achieve with young people. So, you know, we've got 75 or 80 different projects that young people can engage in. Science and technology is still at the core of what it is we do. And STEM education is a national effort that Extension is engaged in, especially with 4-H and youth.
Well, let me ask you this, because I imagine there are a lot of these. What are the greatest misconceptions that people have about what 4-H is and what it's all about today?
Yeah, I would say that people in Milwaukee would say 4-H isn't for me because we don't live on a farm and we don't raise pigs or cows, or we don't have a dairy animal in the backyard. What we know is in our state is that about 7% of our population is engaged in production agriculture. About 10% of our youth population in 4-H programs come from farms, and that's primarily because our reach into rural areas, there aren't as many other youth development opportunities for young people as there are in more urban areas. But when we tell people that 4-H is for anyone, any young person, anywhere, and what it is we achieve, we start to get more people engaged.
Well, and so how much of your membership is in larger, more urban areas or suburban areas like Milwaukee or Madison or even the other cities like Eau Claire and La Crosse?
Sure. When you take a look at the raw numbers that we have across the state, we had about 150,000 young people across the state of Wisconsin engaged in our programs. 10% of those young people live on farms. And other than that, we have reach into every single county. And we have 15,000 volunteers that work with us in helping to deliver programs to young people. Well, so it's for everyone around the state.
Let's talk a little bit about the programs. What are the kinds of things that are the most popular? What are young people most interested in participating in?
You know, one of the interesting things to me is that the media drives some of the things that occur. And here on the state fairgrounds for the last few days, there has been an archery display over here in the natural resources area. And archery is one of the top newer programs that is really drawing great membership. And it's because of the Hunger Games. And Katniss, who's an archer, and we have a lot of girls that are really taking up archery and really excelling.
That image of the strong girl with the bow and arrow is interesting that's now connected not only with the Hunger Games but with 4-H.
Absolutely. One of the things we know too from some of our research is that girls in 4-H, because of the challenges and the opportunities that they have to learn and the questions that they ask, it's all about inquiry. And we know that scientists ask a lot of questions. And at the core of that is just inquisitiveness. And girls in our programs, because they identify things that they want to learn, are twice as likely as other young girls to pursue careers related to science, to take science-related classes. It's one of the real successes I think we have in our programs, especially when we hear in the news how women are not represented equitably in science-related industries.
Well, and to that end, what are the kinds of programs and organizations that 4-H is now involved with that didn't used to be the case? Who are your partners out in the community?
You know, around the country, we have a public-private partnership with a national 4-H council that does fundraising and development on our behalf. We have a Wisconsin 4-H Foundation. Microsoft is a new partner nationally. They're considering doing some work here in Wisconsin with us. United Healthcare is with us. We have a lot of other nationally known companies that are really engaging with 4-H youth development because of what we offer.
Now, I remember when I was in 4-H, one of the big things was to come to the fair with whatever you had, whether you had, you were growing pumpkins or you were having a garden that 4-H inspectors would come to your house and make sure you were growing things, or if you had pigs or sheep or that sort of thing. What kind of involvement do 4-H'ers have here at the state fair?
Well, I think we need to take a look at both county fairs and state fairs. State fair is kind of a culmination of young people that have excelled in their county fairs, where there are opportunities to really reflect upon the learning that's taken place. And that's what we're about in education, is reflecting on our learning. And it's about demonstrating through the projects that they take, the animals that are here, the other exhibits that we have in our 4-H displays, that young people visit with judges, and judges say, this is what I like, this is what I don't like. When we have showmanship exhibits, you know, part of it is about the product. It might be about the animal and their conformation and how well they conform to the perfection, the standard of perfection. And part of it is what young people have learned. And so our focus is really on the child more than the product. And the project that they take, the animal that they raise, is it's a means to a greater end. And the greater end is about life skills, and it's about communication skills and decision making and responsibility. Some of those things that are important to employers no matter where you happen to live, and it's about preparing young people for the rest of their lives.
I think you may have just answered this question, but let me ask it to you in a slightly different way. I mean, it's 2017, and there are a lot of opportunities for young people in rural, suburban, and urban areas. Why is it still so important for 4-H to be there and doing what it does at this point in time?
Well, one of the things is we, as a public organization, funded primarily with tax dollars, with going back to the Morrill Act of 1862, it's about federal funding through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where we started. It's about state funding through the state legislature and University of Wisconsin Extension. And it's about our county partners, our county boards of supervisors who support us. So we've got an obligation, number one. And we just need to be able to do the marketing and really be able to get people engaged in our programs and really understand the results we achieve.
How many kids are showing things and doing things in the state fair this year?
Thousands.
Thousands.
I wish I had a number.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've got kids from all over the state, and dairy and beef and sheep and swine and rabbits and poultry. We have other young people that have got exhibits in woodworking and clothing and arts-related projects. We have young people that have been part of our drama company that are here. We've got a leadership group that was really helping out a lot last night with the governor's Blue Ribbon Meat Products Auction. We have young people engaged in a lot of different opportunities here at the fair consistently, as well as in the natural resources area where we've got some UW Extension exhibits going on.
Given the amount of time and effort the 4-H kids and volunteers put in before they come here, what are your feelings as the state youth program director for 4-H when you walk around the state fair and you see the results of all of this effort?
Well, I have nothing but pride about our young people and the work that they do. And I have a lot of anticipation for the growth that we have when people really see what young people have done.
And I have to ask also your favorite part of the fair, besides the 4-H exhibits and things, what do you like to do when you're not on the job?
Well, I have to have at least one cream puff a day. You know, it's my RDA, my recommended daily allowance of cream puffs. So I've got to do that. I love walking around the state fair. We have some great donors that are part of the state fair. I like visiting with people and seeing old friends. That's all part of the state fair experience for me.
Dale Lighthizer is the State Program Director of the 4-H Youth Development Program. Dale, it's been a thrill to have you here. Thank you so much, and hope you can stick around for a few more minutes.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more of Lake Effect from the Energy Park, the We Energies Energy Park at the Wisconsin State Fair. We'll be joined by gardening expert Melinda Myers when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
More of Lake Effect now from the We Energies Energies Park, right here on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We are at the Wisconsin State Fair this morning and on a stage that for our next guest is her regular habitat for the nearly 2 weeks of the fair. Melinda Myers is Lake Effect's gardening contributor, but she is also the author of numerous books that help people around the Midwest and the country beautify their yards and or their balconies and grow food and also star of television and a big star on this stage as well.
Very much so. It's a perfect fit to be joined this morning by Melinda Myers, fresh from her induction into the Garden Writers Hall of Fame. Congratulations on that, Melinda.
Thank you.
That was just a couple of days ago. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's always great to be here and chat gardening.
So every year there is a theme to this space here in Energy Park. Can you tell us what inspired the landscape that's around us right now? Because you're intimately involved with growing things and this really, this beautiful space that's been going in for a while now.
You bet. We Energies has been very generous with giving me some liberties to help create this beautiful garden. And the Wisconsin Landscape Contractors Association, Milwaukee Metro Chapter, and the Commercial Flower Growers of Wisconsin help beautify. So we have a lot of people contributing. And our goal is to look for ways to help people have fun but be successful in their garden. Some tips and things that they can come to the garden, not only enjoy this green oasis in the state fair, but also go, oh, I could do that at home, or this is a great idea. So we change up the theme. We're always looking for energy efficiency, of course, because I'm at We Energy, but they give me a lot of liberties. And if you grow your own food, you're really reducing consumption of fuel, because food travels, what, 1,500, 1,800 miles from the source to our kitchen table. So this is one way we can have better flavor, more nutrition, and reduce energy consumption. Plus, once you've had a tomato fresh from the garden, it's hard to go back.
I noticed there's some growing right over there hanging
see,
from the
yes,
pot.
I see, yes. What, banana peppers
and a
here?
Banana pepper, exactly. So I'm a container gardener forever. I lived in the city for 26 years with a small city lot, and so I can really sympathize with the lack of space. I have more room now, but I still do containers. I love to have food right outside my kitchen door, because you know what? You're cooking, you forget that basil, so you can run right out and get it, or you want to bring the hummingbirds and butterflies right to your living room window, so when you're sitting inside or fixing food, look out the kitchen and see that wildlife.
There is something to be said for in the middle of this big concrete area where people are buying cream puffs and stuff fried on a stick, that there is stuff growing here that will also end up on people's plates.
You bet. So we cover the nutritional end of things before it gets fried. So, you know, helping people find those cultivars that are beautiful to put in their flower gardens but tasty to put into their stomachs. So, you know, we all break our diets every once in a while. If I did a cream puff a day, however, I would be rolling on the stage. But, you know, there's peppers and tomatoes and kale and Swiss chard that's pretty and edible. And so we're trying to give you ideas of how you can include that, because you find if you grow the vegetables or kids grow vegetables, they're more likely to eat them. And that goes for adults. I meet a lot of adults that don't eat their vegetables, but once they start growing them, they're more likely to at least have some of those and clean off their plate.
Well, the taste is just so much better.
It is. It's like nothing you've had if you haven't had homegrown vegetables or fresh from the farmer's market.
You have lots of folks who come and see your twice daily presentations. Are you getting specific questions this year that might be a little different from what you usually get?
You know, Japanese beetles are always popular. Every session I've had someone ask, because they are a pretty big pest.
Or maybe they're unpopular.
I think they're unpopular. That's a good point. And tomatoes. And since we're focusing on food, I answer questions on anything garden related. Tomatoes, with our crazy weather, you know, cool temperatures and high temperatures, we had both this summer, sometimes interferes with pollen development and viability. And so some people are seeing lots of green tomatoes and waiting for them to ripen, which always seems to be a yearly problem. But maybe it's have great plants that are just now starting to flower and fruit. So the rain, the weather, every year makes it a little different, but that's what's exciting about gardening.
You know, when we think of landscaping, we think of the decorative plants as the ones that beautify our yard. Is there anything mutually exclusive about growing food and having a garden that is aesthetically pleasing?
No, not at all. You know, and I think a lot of the breeders are really helping us, because there's more compact varieties, those with more decorative fruit, so they fit in nicely with your flower gardens. You know, instead of a shade tree or crab apple, and I love crab apples, but how about a real apple that you can harvest? I have a crop of peaches ready to harvest at home. And
you did not bring us any.
I'm sorry. I was running late. I'll have to drop them off at the studio and pay penance. But one of the nice things is, you know, it's not the crop you're going to have bushels and bushels for many years, but when you have a peach right from the tree, it's worth all the effort.
there are people growing things like figs here now, too.
I've had good success. I lost mine over winter, but that's part of gardening. But I had them for about 5 years. And the cool part is you can either bring them in for the winter, or the hardy Chicago hardy fig or brown turkey are hardy in our area, so you can plant them outside in a sheltered location. And how fun is that, you know, to be able to take your guest out and bring figs fresh from the garden and serve them up?
I've got a strange question that just occurred to me, because I've been growing vegetables this year and fruits, and they're going crazy. I catch myself talking to them.
Cleveland Baxter would be proud. This was a guy back in the 80s, I've been around for a while, who did write a book about talking to your plants. He swears it makes a difference. I figure if you're talking to your plants, you care enough about them to tend them properly. So whether you and he are right or a little crazy, either way, you're going to have a good harvest. And at gardening, not only is the nutritional value there, but there's research that shows it lowers blood pressure, it elevates your mood, kids have less problems with ADHD symptoms, and girls are more confident when raised in a landscape environment. So it does good things beyond what we eat.
Is there a particular connection that you feel with the agricultural tradition that forms the backbone of a state fair? I mean, this is not, you know, growing acres of crop of corn or soybeans or you know, some major cash crop. What do you feel is your connection here to what the fair is all about?
Well, you know what? I think we're the segue. So for an urban gardener that maybe has never visited a farm, they may have raised a tomato in a pot, or maybe I can inspire them to do just that. And they come to this beautifully landscaped area, and once you start gardening, you have a greater appreciation for what the farmers go through. I mean, you know, if insects take out my home garden or we get flooded out, it's a bad day, but that's not my livelihood. I can go somewhere and purchase my food, and I still am going to get a paycheck from my company. But if I'm a farmer, it's bad news. So I think gardening helps us appreciate what the farmers do. It gets us in tune with nature. And I think we're so removed from nature so often with our computers and being in the house that it connects us to that. And my uncles and my dad were farmers, so I have that connection myself. So the fair for me, it's about the agriculture first and foremost. And then this garden allows me to kind of bring that urban influence in.
Are you finding that there are specific things to this growing season that people, we talked a little bit about it, but I was thinking my basil plants are just being eaten alive. Is that the Japanese beetles?
Japanese beetles, yeah. Love the basil. The other thing is all the rain that many of us have experienced. If you have heavy soil, you may see some rotting problems. You look at our gardens, they're prolific. We've got some really good soil we've worked on for years, so all this moisture has helped them be bigger than ever before. So the moisture's been good for some, a little too much for others. The fluctuating temperatures and the cool, wet spring, we're seeing some disease issues, but overall, the plants and the weeds, of course, are doing great.
So any way to mitigate some of those issues for a home gardener?
You know, I think this fall, if you did have moisture problems and flooding, add organic matter. Shred up your fall leaves. Dig them into those annual flower beds. You'll greatly improve the soil. Adding organic matter, whether it's compost or the raw material in fall so it breaks down over winter, is a great way to improve moisture absorption so we have less runoff, but also improve drainage so you have less standing water.
We're chatting in the middle of August, and you know, we look over here and the tomatoes are small and not quite ripe yet, and I'm thinking of the tomatoes in my yard, and they are larger but still not quite ripe yet. So we're thinking of the things that we're going to be picking in the coming weeks. But are there things that we can still be putting into the ground in August?
Oh, you bet. This is still, there's plenty of time to plant. And so one of the things, think of the plants that like it cool, radishes, lettuce, spinach. Those are things that really do better in cooler temperatures. And most of them are ready in 30, 40 or less days. Our average fall frost first fall frost is usually the third week in October in southeast Wisconsin. Now that can vary from year to year, but that's still about 70 days left. So you can plant. There's baby kale that's ready in about 25 or 30 days, so you could plant it, harvest it. And if you're learning to embrace the flavor of kale, baby kale's a good way to start.
I was going to say, I like the baby kale. It's wonderful if you chop it up in omelets.
It is. And yeah. So it's a little milder. So if you can't handle the big kale.
Yeah, it's a kale fan that just
exactly.
Drove by.
I'm sorry, I was slandering kale here.
It can be bitter, but if you cook it right, and it also makes wonderful chips.
Exactly. Anything fried right
or baked,
salted.
In this
yes,
case,
and
yeah.
baked. We're going to
yes.
keep it healthy.
Keep it healthy.
Some of us find it makes wonderful compost.
Even Dr. Zorba Pester does, too.
Yes.
And I think when you harvest spinach and lettuce and radishes in the fall, the flavor's much better and milder. It's not as bitter as when we harvest in the heat of the summer, if the plant survived the heat.
So we mentioned this in the intro. You were just inducted into the Garden Writers Hall of Fame in Buffalo over the weekend. and as you said, the Hall of Fame itself is maybe more of a virtual thing. But can you talk about the tricks of the garden writing trade that you have picked up over the years? When you think about the first garden books that you wrote, you know, some years ago, and the kinds of stuff that you're writing today, what's changed for you? How has it gotten easier or harder?
You know, thank you. And I have to thank all my media partners and We Energy and all the people that have helped me get the word out, because, you know, I could talk all that I want, but if nobody's out there listening, it's not going to help. I remember my first book I wrote and thinking, I write articles all the time. This is a piece of cake. Oh, my. It was not a piece of cake. I really credit my success with my books to the gardeners, because I go out and speak, and gardeners are so generous and share ideas and tips that and ask questions. So I try to focus my efforts on what gardeners need and want to know. Now with social media, you know, it's bite-sized bits of information. And our radio and TV tips are 54 seconds. And people go, really? What can you do in 54 seconds? Well, you guys know you can get a lot of information and keep people's attention for 54 seconds. I still love the long format of speaking to groups. But I also realize we're all busy. And sometimes we need an answer. And so I really continue to focus on answering people's questions, getting timely tips out. And a lot of the digital world is allowing me to do that. So people who are up at 3 in the morning, that's usually when I do my research, they can get the answers they need.
I mean, I was just going to say.
Yeah. The Twitter feed, the gardening Twitter feed.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yep. And it's a great way to just kind of, oh, that's a cool idea. I need to try it. Pinterest, if you want to get some ideas for container combinations, there's lots of ideas out there on the internet.
Do you come out of the state fair your times here with ideas that you take out of this space to your own yard?
Oh, you bet. You know, this is a great place to try things. I like to see how the gardens do. We've got plans to do a little renovation, because you can see the plants are doing a little too well in some places. And then also the planters on the fairgrounds are gorgeous. And so I look at those combinations as well. So I love to do the green and growing garden walk, because then I take ideas home for my own garden and to share with others.
I think we have time for one more question. We'll do a quick question first. How many years have you been coming to the State Fair?
Okay, we keep forgetting. It's over 15. It's either 15 or 17. I need to look in my records. But it's been quite a few, and I'm very grateful. It's always been fun.
So aside from your own presentations and the time you spend in this energy park space, what are your favorite memories and the things that you always want to do in, you know, the copious amount of downtime you have?
You know, I love taking my grandkids through the animal barns, because that's what I did as a child. And a quick story, my granddaughter wanted to pet a cow, and I said, well, you have to ask the owner. So she goes up, she was 3 at the time, can I pet your cow? And the farmer goes, what, you want to buy it? And she goes, no, I just want to pet it. And so it was a great moment that she got to relate to that farmer, pet his cow, and a great memory for all of us to take on for years to come.
That's great. Well, Melinda Myers, garden expert, Lake Effect gardening contributor, and author of numerous books on gardening, thank you so much. Stick around on stage, because we're going to have all of our guests come back in just a moment. You're listening to Lake Effect from the State Fair on Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before we return to the stage at We Energy's Energy Park at the State Fair, we have a few minutes to talk about what a power company has to do with agriculture and an event like the State Fair.
Jason Colwelter is Manager of Agriculture and Customer-Owned Generation for We Energies. I asked him about the overlap between We Energies and what the State Fair is all about.
Well, agriculture is an $88 billion industry in Wisconsin, and about half of that, or about $43 billion, is dairy. And so they are very large customers, and typically on a rural part of our distribution system. So we work with customers for on-farm wiring safety, rewiring, energy efficiency, any needs they may have as they look to build another barn or change some of their electrical system and upgrade it.
Well, and I gather there are incentive programs to get more farmers and more rural customers to seek more energy efficient ways of doing business.
That is correct. On farms, we work with a variety of things, and one of the biggest things is fans and lighting. The fans keep the cows cool and comfortable, so they continue to produce good quality and be very productive in the milk. And the lighting is, a lot of farms use long day lighting for additional production. It kind of tricks a cow into believing there's more daylight hours. So there's a lot of lights in these facilities. So we work with our focus on energy for the energy efficiency and the lighting on farms.
What are the chief challenges that you deal with on a daily basis, the kinds of things that might keep you up at night, regardless of the lighting that might make it seem daylight?
Well, the challenge has really become, as farms continue to get larger and they are in the rural areas of our distribution system, we have to build our system, and it's hard for one to build it very large for one customer. So we have to work with the customers, see what alternatives they have, and work with the energy efficiency to meet their needs and keep them productive and keep the costs low for everyone involved.
It's interesting, in our broadcast, our live broadcast here at the State Fair, one of the historical notes that was brought up was that the State Fair was kind of responsible for convincing the state to pay to pave roads in rural parts of the state. And, you know, you think about power distribution, and it's basically its own road system.
It is really the exact same thing. We're trying to get to the customers out there, and the farmers, as everyone knows, are not in downtown Milwaukee for the most part. So trying to get the needs and meet their needs out there.
What do you know, you're sitting staffing one of the booths here in Energy Park. Are there kinds of questions that you get working for We Energies at a place like the State Fair?
At the State Fair, very much so, in the barns and whatnot. We work with the customers. We're involved with dairy promotions here within the state and State Fair Dairy Promotion Board. Two of us are on involved with that. So we get a lot of questions, and we also work with the milking demonstrations just to educate people about what goes on in the farm, because not every day do they get to see that in Milwaukee here.
Well, and so when you meet somebody and you tell them what you do and you kind of explain it, what do you think surprises people the most about what you do?
I think the biggest thing is the impact of agriculture on the state, and that We Energies does have an agriculture program to work directly with those customers, just as we do with any of our large customers out there.
Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jason Kohlwelter is Manager of Agriculture and Customer-Owned Generation for We Energies.
And we'll return to the Wisconsin State Fair in just a moment on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Welcome back to Lake Effect at the We Energies Energy Park here at the State Fair. You're listening to us on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. I am in the audience right now because we've invited our guests to come back on stage. They are all holding some food that they are ready to tuck into. But we had one question from our audience, so we have a couple minutes. Let me have you introduce yourself. What is your name and where are you from?
Hi, I'm Mary Jean. I'm from Greenfield. And I have snow on the mountain in my yard. And in the last few years, my snow on the mountain is losing its snow. Why?
Snow on the mountain is...
And tell us what snow on the mountain is for those of us who are newbies to snow on the mountain.
Snow on the mountain is an old plant, and it actually is kind of entered the invasive plant list because it does take over, as you find out. It's a variegated ground cover that has white variegation, but then it reverts back to the straight species of green, which is even more aggressive than the variegated variety. So most people are trying to get rid of it. So just prune out the green, and that'll let the variegated take over if you want to keep it. If you want to get rid of it, it's years of digging and maybe using a total vegetation killer to kill it and avoid treating your good plants that are probably intermixed with it. So it's normal for it to revert. It gets even more aggressive, and I wish you good luck managing it.
All right. Well, with that in mind, we are going to talk about snow inside the buns here, which is my new euphemism for cream puffs. We have a few more minutes to chat with our guests about a very serious State Fair-related topic. Kyle Cherik talked a little bit about this history a little while ago, but we're joined by Kyle and Dale Lighthizer and Melinda Myers on the stage. And because this is the State Fair, we have a vital question that should help fairgoers, all of you here gathered, or people listening who are still going to the fair over the next few days. What is the proper way to eat a Wisconsin State Fair cream puff?
And we put this question to the Lake Effect staff not too long ago, and we all came up with our own not very neat ways of doing it. And the results are on our website, wuwm.com. But let's turn to our experts. Kyle?
Well, so I ate a cream puff on camera, season 7, I believe, of Wisconsin Foodie with Dave Schmidt, who runs the entire baking operation for the Wisconsin Baking Association and oversees the production of hundreds of thousands of cream puffs. And he had some technique, which is there's a twist and a scoop, right? And then you bite off of it as if it were an enormous Ritz cracker full of great Wisconsin dairy. My twist on that is that you need something on the nose because
it is an olfactory experience,
and we have more taste buds actually up in our sinuses than we do in our throats.
So you're smelling the cream is
yeah,
what you're saying.
Right. You need a 360 kind of thing, and then a deep bite.
Kyle, I feel like this is a variation on my technique, which is to get as much into my mustache as I can, which located right under the nose.
That's key, because yep. Then it's still there if you're hungry.
But this is for those of us who don't have mustaches. We can use your technique.
Yeah. And you should look like this. Ha! It's radio. But you need to have whipped cream on your upper lip, as if you had a temporary mustache, on your nose. Cheeks optional. I mean, however you want to roll. But it's an olfactory experience and then a flavor experience.
All right.
So somebody else should... I'll hold both mics here. I'll do a two-handed mic thing. So we'll just go across the stage. And Melinda Myers, you've been coming for 15 years or more. Tell us how... there you go. Bonnie's got the mic now.
Well, I'm not quite as thoughtful as you because I want to dig right in. But I do a twist, kind of like an Oreo. Now I need to work on the scoop because I left half of the cream inside. So I do it like an Oreo. Twist it, eat it separately so that I don't end up with the cream all down the front of my shirt because that's usually where it goes, not on my face.
If you're wearing it, it's a good meal?
I guess so. And
we'll
then
ask you
again
to take,
for later.
You can take a little bite, but I know you probably don't want to get too much on your clothes right before your first gardening presentation of the day.
Very good.
Okay.
As always.
Dale Lighthizer's on this side of the stage. I've got this microphone. This will be all right. And you eat a cream puff every day, so I would imagine you have technique.
Well, I have two techniques. If I have a shower available, I do the full load here, top on bottom, cream in the middle, and I'll go that route. Here at the State Fair, without a shower immediately available, I do the twist and eat too. So sometimes I have a third alternative, which is the first bite, full-blown, both sides, all at once. Yeah, and the plate is necessary just to catch whatever the cream is that just comes out the side.
That's sheer insanity, by the way. Yes. Yeah, and you never, wow.
Oh, he's pretty good.
He is an artiste.
Yeah. So for the two of you who split and scooped, what do you do with the bottom part?
It's gone.
I noticed that.
Kyle, you got through your entire cream puff.
You fold it in like a New York-style pizza. You manage the cream as it comes up like the top of a volcano, and you just commit.
So it's kind of like a cream puff taco.
Yeah.
Is a cream puff a sandwich?
No. It's a puff. It's a pastry. It's different.
Well, with that in mind, that's going to wrap up today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for joining us today at the Wisconsin State Fair. It has been a pleasure. Thanks to We Energies for providing the stage.
Right. Special thanks to our staff, including engineer Jason Reavy and Lake Effect producers Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski, plus Karen Ryan and Kathy Schultz of We Energies for hosting us here.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
And stay tuned for those of you who are here at the State Fair. Melinda is going to plant some cream puffs after this.
So be careful how you squeeze her. Please don't ever tease her. She's my cream puff.